This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We have more than 28 countries on the continent that are interested at the moment in introducing the vaccine.
That's WHO official Magai Wa Magaf on the new malaria vaccine for Africa. Details coming up. Also, Nigeria says average daily petrol consumption has fallen by 28%. And Esop Pahad, a veteran of South Africa's struggle against apartheid, has died. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. African countries will receive 18 million doses of the first ever vaccine against malaria over the next 2 years. The vaccine has been administered to more than 1.6 million children in Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi since 2019. It's been shown to be safe and effective and has resulted in a substantial reduction in severe malaria and drop in the number of child deaths. Magai Wa Magaf is a WHO vaccination official in the Republic of Congo. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam how the rollout will happen.
This is the first ever malaria vaccine that we have. It's called RTSS, and the trade name is Mosquirix, and it's manufactured by GSK, who are based in the UK.
How many countries in Africa will be getting it?
Yes, first of all, I would like to say that the number of countries that has expressed interest to introduce the vaccine is very high. We have more than 28 countries on the continent that are interested at the moment in introducing the vaccine. We have supply challenges, and so we have developed a framework to allocate the available number of vaccine doses to the countries in a way that is fair and equitable. Now, applying that framework, it's 12 countries that are going to get the vaccine at the moment. Three of those have been receiving the vaccine under a pilot program, and those are Kenya, Ghana, and Malawi, and they have been implementing the vaccine for more than 3 years. They started in 2019, and so they have quite some experience. The other countries, the newcomers, they are 9, and they are Benin, Burkina Faso, Burundi, Cameroon, DRC, Congo, Liberia, Nigeria, Sierra Leone, and Uganda. So that makes it a total of 12 countries. The initial 3 countries plus the new 9 countries.
Wow, that's a lot. How are you doing this? How are you distributing them?
Yes. First of all, the funding for the introduction usually comes from Gavi, and the Gavi works with the partners. So these countries applied for a grant to introduce the vaccine, and they got the applications accepted by Gavi. So Gavi will be funding the introduction. Of course, partners also fill in the gaps where they are, and those that are dealing with the procurement are UNICEF. So UNICEF will be procuring the vaccine from the manufacturer and then shipping the vaccine doses to these countries. WHO is providing technical assistance, and we've been working with Gavi and UNICEF to make sure that the introduction is a success.
You work with UNICEF like this and you get it to the countries, then what? Does it go to hospitals and health clinics?
Yes. First of all, this is a commodity that has to be approved by the authorities in the countries. And each of the countries have got a national regulatory authority, the equivalent of the US FDA, and that has to license the vaccine before the vaccine can be accepted to get into the country. Now, that process is ongoing for most of the countries that have not done so. And so once that permit is there, there will be a permit to import the vaccine into the country. And once it's received in the country, it is going to be sent at the major deposit for the country for vaccines. That is at the national level. And then from the national level, it's distributed to the districts as they need arises.
That was Magai Wamagafu, a WHO vaccination official in the Republic of Congo, speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam. Could Afrocentrism be a new game changer for schools in Africa? Children in Freedom School, a little-known educational institution in Kenya's Nakuru County, is disrupting the traditional education system. The school is generating a buzz in Kenya and globally after being ranked among the top 10 schools, making a difference. And the overcoming adversity category for instilling a deep sense of pride, critical thinking, innovation, self-efficacy, and entrepreneurship among the students. For more, VOA's Pauline Diho spoke via Skype with Dr. Utiri Kanyo, co-founder of Children in Freedom School.
The first time I talked to you, it was during the pandemic. You had started at this school. You were one of the pioneers to bring technology into schools. When the schools shut down all over the world, you came up with an e-learning model. And it has since kicked off, and you are doing very, very well.
Since 2020... we've been still spotlighting the African culture and positive African narratives for our children. We come from a backdrop of a lot of negative narratives about Africa, Africans, Black people. And if we don't take it into our hands, make it our own responsibility, to edify our children, to encourage our children and make them feel proud to be Africans. Children in Freedom School has even gone deeper and wider into Afrocentric learning, where we don't only follow the Kenyan curriculum of education, but we add value by taking children into the histories, empowering histories of the African, of the Black people, the innovations of their forefathers, the great wealth of their continent, just positive vibes about self and identity.
For purposes of our audience, you talked about Afrocentric. What do you mean exactly?
Afrocentric means simply Africa-centered. Africa-centered. That whatever it is that you're doing, you put your lens on Africa, African culture, African ideologies, African narratives, just the African way of life.
You talked about how from the time you're kids, you're taught about Africa in a negative way. You look to the West, you look to the East, you say, hey, those places are better. If I grow up, I want to go there. Kids aspire to come to the West and to the East. How is it being received on your end?
Very well, but it's taken time. So the school is now 5 years old. I can say it's taken these 5 years for people to not fear being Africa-centered or an Africa-centered institution. I could honestly say that initially there was a lot of suspicion. And it goes back to how we have been, I can say, indoctrinated or socialized in a Eurocentric way, that the African way has witchcraft, the African way is not up to speed, is not up to standard. But with time and with the outcome and outputs of the school, that children are doing just as well academically, if not better. Their confidence has hit the roof. Children are so proud to be African. They love having this black color, this melanin. And it doesn't remove them away from doing technology, learning foreign languages. So we have been used to show that Afrocentrism, you can be African and proud and still be global and still embrace other cultures.
What's the enrollment like?
At the moment, we have 300 children in the school.
You've done incredibly well. You are getting this international recognition now. You have a lot of people interested in what you are teaching these kids. Bring us up to speed.
An international or global shortlisting from the world's best school prizes. the World Best School Prizes spotlights schools that are doing innovative work, community-based work, a work that is going just beyond the classroom, going beyond the maths and English, in making the world a better place and in using the talents of the teachers, the educators, and the learners. So we have been shortlisted in a category that is called Overcoming Adversity, which is, as it says, that the school has overcome a challenge and an adversity that's in their community, in their society. And for us, the adversity that we have overcome is the lack of the African culture, African languages, African presence in our school curriculum.
That was Dr. Utoru Kanyo, co-founder of Children in Freedom School, speaking with VOA's Paul Ndiho from Nakuru, Kenya. The Nigerian government says the country's average daily petrol consumption has fallen by 28% since President Bola Tinubu scrapped a popular but costly fuel subsidy at the end of May. The Nigerian Midstream and Downstream Petroleum Regulatory Authority says average daily gasoline consumption fell to 48.43 million liters in June from the previous average of 66.9 million. Reuters News notes that the government spent $10 billion on subsidized fuel last year, leading to wider deficits and driving up government debt. It says since the subsidy was ended, a black market has collapsed in neighboring Cameroon, Benin, and Togo that relied on fuel smuggled from Nigeria. Nigeria's President Bola Tinubu has ordered the suspension of a newly introduced 10% tax on single-use plastics and excise duty on some locally manufactured products in order to reduce business costs. The president's spokesman, Dele Alaki, said Tinubu signed executive orders suspending a tax on plastic containers and bottles that was introduced in March. Alaki said the president is working towards eliminating the impact of the tax adjustments on businesses and the chokehold on households across affected sectors. Reuters News notes that Nigeria is one of the biggest plastic polluters on the continent, creating some 2.5 million tons of plastic waste annually, some of which ends up in the sea. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Studies show Africa's space sector is steadily expanding, with over 20 countries establishing national space initiatives and plans to launch more than 100 additional satellites by 2025. Some experts think Africa lags behind in the space race and should do more. Ethiopian-American space scientist Dr. Baruch Lako is the Associate Director of Planning and Research and Development, Solar System Exploration Division at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center outside Washington. In a visit to our Washington, D.C. studios, he tells VOA's Jackson Mfunganye, even though space exploration requires many resources, it is necessary if Africa is to become less reliant on foreign technology and take control of its own environmental and national security.
A question that many people ask, I think, is part of a wider debate of the U.S. and other developing countries spend billions of dollars for space exploration. And they're asking, is there justification to spend that much resources to go to the moon and other places in space when there's a lot of suffering? There's so much need for the resources here on Earth. What is your take on that?
Yeah, I've thought about this issue. Africa needs to be in space. There's no choice, in my view. Being behind in that area costs African nations quite a lot. For instance, for communication, for telephone, for education, remote education to their provinces and stuff. They pay hundreds of millions of dollars rent to get the bandwidth from private satellites and so on and so forth. Even, you know, if you look at that, it'd be enormous saving if they had their own communication satellite. And also now, with the miniaturization that I mentioned, you have CubeSats. They're like 10-centimeter cube. Mm. And that's one unit. You can have a 6U where you can have quite a few things and that you can launch.
Is that what we hear when we, for example, like Uganda sent a satellite to space recently and,
Kenya.
And Kenya?
Kenya did one.
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, what's different about the Kenyan satellite, it was built by engineers from a private company in Kenya. That's a departure from all
private
government.
Sector private investment sector. In space in Africa is happening.
And was launched by SpaceX.
Yeah.
And so that's very early stage, but it should be encouraged. I think Africa is wasting quite a bit of resources through internal wars and stuff. You know, I'm not saying it's only in Africa, because wars happen around the world, as we know now. But leaders should make every effort possible to avoid these things and focus on what's important for the future. It's being present in space is controlling your own financial transactions, controlling how you grow crops from space. You can map, you can see where moisture is low or high and so on and so forth. It's even important for national security. So it's not a choice. You have to be there. And to do so, I think, cooperations,
yes.
Like Kenya has on San Marco Island, a launch pad that Italians use. It's near the equator. As you know, when you launch from the equator, you get the Earth rotates faster at the equator, so you get all that velocity attached to it. And so, you know, the launch could be in Kenya. The satellite could be assembled in Uganda. Some of the electronics could be done in Ethiopia and so on.
And research happens some other places.
It's safe.
Engineers
yes, absolutely. It's not, so it's
is
not
that,
prohibitively difficult. Anymore.
Right. I mean, prohibitive in terms of resources could be, but when you pool resources, I guess.
Absolutely.
But is Africa falling behind the space race at this point? Is that something that worries you?
It worries me, yes. Nigeria has done several iterations of space launch. For instance, they hired an English company that did their first satellite. They had their engineers go in England to work. But now they're gradually moving the control center in Nigeria and then doing some of the work in their own. So there's a lot of not highly organized Africa-wise, but these countries are trying their best.
Is space exploration the only way to ensure survival of the human species?
That's a good one.
Do we have to do this for our own survival?
Well, I think for the near future, we're stuck here on this planet.
Yeah.
Because if you look at Mars, which is really a close cousin to Earth, the atmosphere is pretty much gone. There's very little atmosphere, and that's carbon dioxide. So one would have to release a lot of oxygen from the rocks.
Warm up the rocks and release it to
chemically remove and then reform the atmosphere that was there before. And that would take
the ozone layer too.
You need a couple of hundred thousand years to form the atmosphere. So we have to take care of our own planet first.
Okay.
I think really make some drastic policy changes to make sure that climate change.
So use our presence in the sky, in the space, to maintain, leverage that to create a conducive environment here on Earth.
Yes.
For us and for future generations.
Yes. While we work on Mars or the moon.
That was Ethiopian-American space scientist Dr. Baruch Lakau. He was speaking to VOA's Jackson Mfunganyi. The UN Special Envoy to Libya, Abdoulaye Batali, says the country has reached a decisive stage on the path to elections. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi the major challenges in holding elections in Libya.
So there are many issues. The biggest one is who can run. And the other two big issues for the last scheduled elections, which never happened, were What does the president do and what does the parliament do? And what do the two governments of East and West, what is the power of the decisions they make during these interim periods? Do they carry over to the new Libya or do, you know, they get thrown out and everything has to be renegotiated? Those were the big old issues. From the negotiations in late May, early June, we have some new issues. One is the sequencing. Do we hold presidential and parliamentary elections at the same time? Do the parliamentary elections happen during the second round of the presidential elections if there's a runoff? There was a big debate around if the presidential elections fail in the first round, does the parliamentary election happen anyway for the second round, you know, at the time when the second round is supposed to happen? There's also this perennial issue of the constitutional basis versus having a constitution. You know, do we need a constitution in place? That wasn't the case for Tunisia. It wasn't the case for Libya previously. And I don't think we need a constitution, but some people are arguing that. And then the question is, are they all these arguments just delaying tactics by the people who want to stay in power and don't want elections? Or are they actual issues that need to be resolved before the elections? I think the issue that's never raised, which is a big issue for me, is what is the national and international election observation going to look like? There's been democratic elections in the West over the last 12 years, but not in the East. And the question is there enough muscle memory about elections that happened in the East, you know, between 2011 and 2014 that can allow for free and fair elections in the East in the context of basically a military run republic that hasn't really had strong democratic credentials?
You recently moderated a panel discussion with the U.S. Special Envoy for Libya, Ambassador Richard Norland, and former U.S. Envoy to Libya, Jonathan Weiner, on prospects for elections in Libya and how Libya may regain the path towards national-level democracy. What did the two U.S. diplomats perceive about the future Libyan elections?
Norland, who's the incumbent envoy, was a little more optimistic. Weiner, who's the former envoy, was a little more pessimistic. Weiner, in his remarks, opened with the metaphor of a lottery, saying that what the East and certain parties seem to want is not an election, but a selection of their candidates. And all these negotiations are about putting the best conditions in place to have a pre-selected winner win. And he said that's like having a lottery where we know who's going to win the lottery before it even happens. He also said, and the other panelists agreed with him, that just setting a date isn't enough. And that's important given what Khaled Mishri, the head of the Western High Council of State, has been saying, that this roadmap is coming out next week and they're going to set a date for March without resolving these issues. And that's precisely the issue we keep having. We set dates and then the elections don't happen because the issues aren't resolved. We had a speaker on the panel from Libya. He's the head of the Libyan National Economic and Social Development Board. And he emphasized that the point here is not to get an election, it's to get to a democracy. Having an election, which just puts an undemocratic government in place, is not what Libyans want. And your listeners may know that there's about 60 countries in the world that have elections, but they're not free and fair, and they're not creating democracies. That's a real risk. It's a lot of countries in the world. His own party is in favor of parliamentary elections first, and that issue came up. But Norland, the current envoy, sort of made the counter argument, which is if you have a parliament without a president, that could create continued political instability, in part because of Libyan culture, which wants a leader, not just a parliament with weak leadership and sort of weak institutions that would have a caretaker role for another year and would be the scene of probably strong struggles without a leader to sort of put things in order. And so what Norland advocated is that both elections take place. I tend to agree with that. It's also the position of the State Department. And I've saw meetings in which they make that case emphatically. The problem here is, how do you get to elections? And then how do you have elections that people will respect after they take place? And Norland emphasized that there has to be buy-in not only to the process, but to the result. Otherwise, a war breaks out potentially after the elections are over. So we just need to go to elections in a way that's palatable to both sides and replace these two houses of parliament, which are creating more problems generally than they're solving.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Shogun Chang, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.